before he goes under is of how Mr. Mercedes' poison pen letter finished up. Mr. Mercedes wants him to commit suicide. Hodges wonders what he would think if he knew he had given this particular ex-knight of the badge and gun a reason to live instead, at least for a while. Then sleep takes him. He gets a full and restful 6 hours before his bladder wakes him. He gropes to the bathroom, pees himself empty, and goes back to bed where he sleeps for another 3 hours. When he wakes, sunshine is slanting in the windows and the birds are twittering. He heads into the kitchen where he cooks himself a full breakfast. As he's sliding a couple of hard-fried eggs onto a plate already loaded with bacon and toast, he stops, startled. Someone is singing. It's him. 6. Once his breakfast dishes are in the dishwasher, he goes into the study to tear the letter down. This is a thing he's done at least 24 times before, but never on his own. As a detective, he always had Pete Huntley to help him, and before Pete, 2 previous partners. Most of the letters were threatening communications from ex-husbands and an ex-wife or two. Not much challenge in those. Some were extortion demands. Some were blackmail, really just another form of extortion. One was from a kidnapper demanding a paltry and unimaginative ransom. And 3, 4, counting the one from Mr. Mercedes, were from self-confessed murderers. 2 of those were clearly fantasy. 1 might or might not have been from the serial killer they called Turnpike Joe. What about this one? True or false? Real or fantasy? Hodges opens his desk drawer, takes out a yellow legal pad, tears off the week-old grocery list on the top. Then he plucks one of the Uniball pens from the cup beside his computer. He considers the detail about the condom first. If the guy really was wearing one, he took it with him. That makes sense, doesn't it? Condoms can hold fingerprints as well as jizz. Hodges considers other details, how the seatbelt locked when the guy plowed into the crowd, the way the Mercedes bounced when it went over the bodies, stuff that wouldn't have been in any of the newspapers, but also stuff he could have made up. He even said, Hodges scans the letter, and here it is. My imagination is very powerful. But there were 2 details he could not have made up, 2 details that had been withheld from the news media. On his legal pad below, is it real? Hodges writes, hairnet, bleach. Mr. Mercedes had taken the net with him, just as he had taken a condom, probably still hanging off his dick, assuming it had been there at all. But Gibson and forensics had been positive there was one because Mr. Mercedes had left the clown mask and there had been no hair stuck to the rubber. About the swimming pool smell of DNA killing bleach, there had been no doubt he must have used a lot. But it isn't just those things. It's everything. The assuredness. There's nothing tentative here. He hesitates, then prints. This is the guy. Hesitates again, scribbles out guy, and prints. Bastard. 7. It's been a while since he thought like a cop, and even longer since he did this kind of work. A special kind of forensics that doesn't require cameras, microscopes, or special chemicals. But once he buckles down to it, he warms up fast. He starts with a series of headings. 1-sentence paragraphs. Capitalized phrases. Phrases in quotation marks. Fancy phrases. Unusual words. Exclamation points. Here he stops, tapping the pen against his lower lip and reading the letter through again from Dear Detective Hodges to hope this letter has cheered you up. Then he adds 2 more headings on the sheet, which is now getting crowded. Uses baseball metaphor. May be a fan. Computer savvy. Under 50? He is far from sure about these last 2. Sports metaphors have become common, especially among political pundits, and These days there are octogenarians on Facebook and Twitter. Hodges himself may be tapping only 12% of his max potential, that's what Jerome claims, but that doesn't make him part of the majority. He had to start somewhere, though, and besides, the letter has a young feel. He has always been talented at this sort of work, and a lot more than 12% of it is intuition. He's listed nearly a dozen examples under unusual words, and now circles two, compatriots and spontaneous ejaculation. Beside them, he adds a name, Wamba. Mr. Mercedes is a shitbag, but a bright book-reading shitbag. He has a large vocabulary and doesn't make spelling errors. Hodges can imagine Jerome Robinson saying, "Spell checker, my man. I mean, duh." Sure, sure, these days anyone with a word processing program can spell like a champ, but Mr. Mercedes has written W-A-M-B-A-U-G-H, not W-O-M-B-O-U-G-H, or even W-O-M-B-O-W. Just the fact that he's remembered to put in that silent G-H suggests a fairly high level of intelligence. Mr. Mercedes' missive may not be high-class literature, but his writing is a lot better than the dialogue in shows like NCIS or Bones. Homeschooled, public schooled, or self-taught? Doesn't matter. Maybe not, but maybe it does. Hodges doesn't think self-taught, no. The writing is too... what? Expansive, he says to the empty room, but it's more than that. Outward. This guy writes outward. He learned with others and wrote for others. A shaky deduction, but it's supported by certain flourishes, those fancy phrases. "Must begin by congratulating you," he writes. "Literally hundreds of cases," he writes. And twice, "Was I on your mind?" Hodges logged A's in his high school English classes, B's in college, and he remembers what that sort of thing is called. Incremental repetition. Does Mr. Mercedes imagine his letter being published in the newspaper, circulated on the internet, quoted with a certain reluctant respect on Channel 4 News at 6. "Sure you do," Hodges says. "Once upon a time you read your themes in class. You liked it, too. Liked being in the spotlight, didn't you? When I find you, if I find you, I'll find that you did as well in your English classes as I did. Probably better." Hodges can't remember ever using incremental repetition unless it was by accident. Only there are four public high schools in the city, and God knows how many private ones. Not to mention prep schools, junior colleges, City College, and St. Jude's Catholic University. Plenty of haystacks for a poisoned needle to hide in. If he even went to school here at all and not in Miami or Phoenix. Plus, he's a sly dog. The letter is full of false fingerprints. The capitalized phrases like "lead boots" and "note of concern." The phrases in quotation marks. The extravagant use of exclamation points. The punchy one-sentence paragraphs. If asked to provide a writing sample, Mr. Mercedes would include none of those stylistic devices. Hodges knows that as well as he knows his own unfortunate first name, Kermit, as in Kermit Frog 19. This asshole isn't quite as smart as he thinks. The letter almost certainly contains two real fingerprints, one smudged and one crystal clear. The smudged print is his persistent use of numbers instead of the words for numbers. 2-7, not T-W-E-N-T-Y-S-E-V-E-N. 4-0, instead of F-O-R-T-Y. Detective 1 ST grade instead of D-E-T-F-I-R-S-T-G-R-A-D-E. There are a few exceptions. He has written O-N-E-R-E-G-R-E-T instead of 1, regret. But Hodges thinks they are the ones that prove the general rule. The numbers might only be more camouflage, he knows that, but the chances are good Mr. Mercedes is genuinely unaware of it. If I could get him in IR4 and tell him to write 40 thieves stole 80 wedding rings. Only K. William Hodges is never going to be in an interview room again, including IR4, which had been his favorite. His lucky IR, he always thought it. Unless he gets caught fooling with this shit, that is, and then he's apt to be on the wrong side of the metal table. All right, then. Pete gets the guy in an IR. Pete or Isabel or both of them. They get him to write, 40 thieves stole 80 wedding rings. What then? Then they ask him to write, the cops caught the perp hiding in the alley. Only they'd want to slur the perp part. Because for all his writing skill, Mr. Mercedes thinks the word for a criminal doer is P-E-R-K. Maybe he also thinks the word for a special privilege is a P-E-R-P, as in traveling first class was one of the CEO's perps. I just wouldn't be surprised. Until college, he himself had thought that the fellow who threw the ball in a baseball game, the thing you poured water out of, and the framed objects you hung on the wall to decorate your apartment were all spelled the same. He had seen the word picture in all sorts of books, but his mind somehow refused to record it. His mother said, "Straighten that picture, Kerm. It's crooked." His father sometimes gave him money for the picture show, and it had simply stuck in his head. "I'll know you when I find you, honey bunch," Hodges thinks. He prints the word and circles it again and again, hemming it in. "You'll be the asshole who calls a perp a perk." 8. He takes a walk around the block to clear his head, saying hello to people he hasn't said hello to in a long time. Weeks, in some cases. Mrs. Melbourne is working in her garden, and when she sees him, she invites him in for a piece of her coffee cake. "I've been worried about you," she says when they're settled in the kitchen. She has the bright, inquisitive gaze of a crow with its eye on a freshly squashed chipmunk. "Getting used to retirement has been hard," he takes a sip of her coffee. "It's lousy, but plenty hot." "Some people never get used to it at all," she says, measuring him with those bright eyes. She wouldn't be too shabby in IR4, Hodges thinks. "Especially ones who had high-pressure jobs."
"I was a little at loose ends to start with, but I'm doing better now."
"I'm glad to hear it. Does that nice Negro boy still work for you?"
"Jerome, yes." Hodges smiles, wondering how Jerome would react if he knew someone in the neighborhood thinks of him as that nice Negro boy. Probably he would bare his teeth in a grin and exclaim, "I sure is." Jerome and his chose for hoes. Already with his eye on Harvard, Princeton as a fallback.
"He's slacking off," she says. "Your lawn's gotten rather shaggy. More coffee?"
Hodges declines with a smile. Hot can only do so much for bad coffee. 9. Back home again. Legs tingling, head filled with fresh air, mouth tasting like newspaper in a birdcage, but brain buzzing with caffeine. He logs on to the city newspaper site and calls up several stories about the slaughter at City Center. What he wants isn't in the first story, published under scare headlines on April 11th of 09, or the much longer piece in the Sunday edition of April 12th. It's in the Monday paper, a picture of the abandoned kill car steering wheel. The indignant caption, "He thought it was funny." In the center of the wheel, pasted over the Mercedes emblem, is a yellow smile face, the kind that wears sunglasses and shows its teeth. There was a lot of police anger about that photo because the detectives in charge, Hodges and Huntley, had asked the news media to hold back the smile icon. The editor, Hodges remembers, had been fawningly apologetic. "A miscommunication," he said. "Won't happen again. Promise. Scout's honor." "Mistake my ass," he remembers Pete fuming. "They had a picture that'd shoot a few steroids into their saggy-ass circulation and they fucking used it." Hodges enlarges the news photo until that grinning yellow face fills the computer screen. The mark of the beast, he thinks, 21st century style.
This time, the number he speed dials isn't PD reception, but Pete's cell. His old partner picks up on a second ring.
Yo, you old horsey horse, how's retirement treating you?
He sounds really pleased, and that makes Hodges smile. It also makes him feel guilty, yet the thought of backing off never crosses his mind.
I'm good, he says, but I miss your fat and hypertensive face. Sure you do, and we won in Iraq.
Swear to God, Peter, how about we have lunch and catch up a little? You pick the place and I'll buy.
Sounds good, but I already ate today. How about tomorrow?
My schedule is jammed. Obama was coming by for my advice on the budget, but I suppose I could rearrange a few things. Seeing how it's you.
Go fuck yourself, Kermit.
When you do it so much better.
The banter is an old tune with simple lyrics.
How about DiMaggio's? You always like that place?
DiMaggio's is fine. Noon?
That works.
And you sure you've got time for an old whore like me?
Billy, you don't even need to ask. Want me to bring Isabel?
He doesn't, but says, if you want. Some of the old telepathy must still be working, because after a brief pause, Pete says,
maybe we'll make it a stag party this time.
Whatever, Hodges says, relieved. Looking forward.
Me too. Good to hear your voice, Billy.
Hodges hangs up and looks at the teeth-bared smile face some more. It fills his computer screen.
10. He sits in his lazy boy that night watching the 11 o'clock news. In his white pajamas, he looks like an overweight ghost. His scalp gleams mellowly through his thinning hair. The big story is the Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico, where the oil is still gushing. The newsreader says the bluefin tuna are endangered and the Louisiana shellfish industry may be destroyed for a generation. In Iceland, a billowing volcano, with a name the newsreader mangles to something like Ejafilkul, is still screwing up transatlantic air travel. In California, police are saying they may have finally gotten a break in the grim sleeper serial killer case. No names, but the suspect, the perk, Hodges thinks, is described as a well-groomed and well-spoken African-American. Hodges thinks, now if only someone would bag Turnpike Joe, not to mention Osama bin Laden. The weather comes on. Warm temperatures and sunny skies, the weather girl promises. Time to break out the bathing suits.
I'd like to see you in a bathing suit, my dear, Hodges says, and uses the remote to turn off the TV.
He takes his father's .38 out of the drawer, unloads it as he walks into the bedroom, and puts it in the safe with his Glock. He has spent a lot of time during the last 2 or 3 months obsessing about the Victory 38, but tonight it hardly crosses his mind as he locks it away. He's thinking about Turnpike Joe, but not really. These days, Joe is someone else's problem. Like the grim sleeper, that well-spoken African-American.
Is Mr. Mercedes also African-American?
It's technically possible. No one saw anything but the pullover clown mask, a long-sleeved shirt, and yellow gloves on the steering wheel. But Hodges thinks not. God knows there are plenty of black people capable of murder in this city, but there's the weapon to consider.
The neighborhood where Mrs. Trelawney's mother lived is predominantly wealthy and predominantly white. A black man hanging around a parked Mercedes SL500 would have been noticed.
Well, probably. People can be stunningly unobservant. But experience has led Hodges to believe rich people tend to be slightly more observant than the general run of Americans, especially when it comes to their expensive toys. He doesn't want to say they're paranoid, but the fuck they're not. Rich people can be generous. Even the ones with blood-curdling political views can be generous, but most believe in generosity on their own terms, and underneath, not so deep either. They're always afraid someone is going to steal their presents and eat their birthday cake.
How about neat and well-spoken, then? Yes, Hodges decides. No hard evidence, but the letter suggests he is.
Mr. Mercedes may dress in suits and work in an office, or he may dress in jeans and Carhartt shirts and balance tires in a garage, but he's no slob. He may not talk a lot,
Such creatures are careful in all aspects of their lives, and that includes promiscuous blabbing. But when he does talk, he's probably direct and clear. If you were lost and needed directions, he'd give you good ones. As he's brushing his teeth, Hodges thinks, DiMaggio's. Pete wants to have lunch at DiMaggio's. That's okay for Pete, who still carries the badge and gun, and it seemed okay to Hodges when they were talking on the phone, because then Hodges had been thinking like a cop instead of a retiree who's 30 pounds overweight. It probably would be okay, broad daylight and all, but DiMaggio's is on the edge of Lowtown, which is not a vacation community. A block west of the restaurant, beyond the Turnpike Spur overpass, the city turns into a wasteland of vacant lots and abandoned tenements. Drugs are sold openly on street corners. There's a burgeoning trade in illegal weaponry, and arson is the neighborhood sport. If you can call Lowtown a neighborhood, that is. The restaurant itself, a really terrific Italian joint, is safe, though. The owner is connected, and that makes it like free parking in Monopoly. Hodges rinses his mouth, goes back into the bedroom, and, still thinking of DiMaggio's, looks doubtfully at the closet where the safe is hidden behind the hanging pants, shirts, and the sport coats he no longer wears. He's now too big for all but two of them. Take the Glock. The Victory, maybe. The Victory's smaller. No. To both. His carry concealed license is still in good standing, but he's not going strapped to a lunch with his old partner. It would make him self-conscious. And he's already self-conscious about the digging he plans to do. He goes to his dresser instead, lifts up a pile of underwear, and looks underneath. The happy slapper is still there, has been there since his retirement party. The slapper will do. Just a little insurance in a high-risk part of town. Satisfied, he goes to bed and turns out the light. He puts his hands into the mystic cool pocket under the pillow and thinks of Turnpike Joe. Joe has been lucky so far, but eventually he'll be caught. Not just because he keeps hitting those highway rest areas, but because he can't stop killing. He thinks of Mr. Mercedes writing, "That is not true in my case, because I have absolutely no urge to do it again." Telling the truth, or lying the way he was lying with his capitalized phrases and many exclamation points and one-sentence paragraphs. Hodges thinks he's lying, perhaps to himself as well as to K. William Hodges, debt rat. But right now, as Hodges lies here with sleep coming on, he doesn't care. What matters is the guy thinks he's safe. He's positively smug about it. He doesn't seem to realize the vulnerability he has exposed by writing a letter to the man who was, until his retirement, the lead detective on the City Center case. You need to talk about it, don't you? Yes, you do, honey bunch. Don't lie to your old Uncle Billy. And unless that Debbie's Blue Umbrella site is another red herring, like all those quotation marks, you've even opened a conduit into your life. You want to talk. You need to talk. And if you could goad me into something, that would just be the cherry on top of a sundae, wouldn't it? In the dark, Hodges says, "I'm willing to listen. I've got plenty of time. I'm retired, after all." Smiling, he falls asleep. 11. The following morning, Freddie Linklater is sitting on the edge of the loading dock and smoking a Marlboro. Her discount electronics jacket is folded neatly beside her with her DE gimme cap placed on top of it. She's talking about some Jesus jumper who gave her hassle. People are always giving her hassle, and she tells Brady all about it on break. She gives him chapter and verse, because Brady is a good listener. So he says to me, he goes, "All homosexuals are going to hell, and this tract explains all about it." So I take it, right? There's a picture in the front of these two narrow-ass gay guys in leisure suits, I swear to God, holding hands and staring into a cave filled with flames. Plus the devil with a pitchfork. I am not shitting you. Still, I try to discuss it with him. I'm under the impression that he wants to have a dialogue. So I say, I go,
You ought to get your face out of the book of Leviticus or whatever it is long enough to read a few scientific studies. Gays are born gay. I mean, hello. He goes, that is simply not true. Homosexuality is learned behavior and can be unlearned. So I can't believe it, right? I mean, you have got to be shitting me. But I don't say that. What I say is, look at me, dude. Take a real good look. Don't be shy. Go top to bottom. What do you see? And before he can toss some more of his bullshit, I go, you see a guy, is what you see. Only God got distracted before he could slap a dick on me and went on to the next in line. So then he goes.
Brady sticks with her, more or less, until Freddy gets to the book of Leviticus. She means Leviticus, but Brady doesn't care enough to correct her, and then mostly loses her keeping track just enough to throw in the occasional, uh-huh. He doesn't really mind the monologue. It's soothing, like the LCD sound system he sometimes listens to on his iPod when he goes to sleep. Freddy Linklater is way tall for a girl. At 6'2 or 3, she towers over Brady, and what she's saying is true. She looks like a girl about as much as Brady Hartsfield looks like Vin Diesel. She's togged out in straight leg 501s, motorcycle skids, and a plain white tee that hangs dead straight without even a touch of tits. Her dark blonde hair is butched to a quarter inch. She wears no earrings, no makeup. She probably thinks Max Factor's a statement about what some guy did to some girl out behind old dad's barn. He says, yeah, and uh-huh, and right, all the time wondering what the old cop made of his letter, and if the old cop will try to get in touch at the Blue Umbrella. He knows that sending the letter was a risk, but not a very big one. He made up a prose style that's completely different from his own. The chances of the old cop picking up anything useful from the letter are slim to non-existent. Debbie's Blue Umbrella is a slightly bigger risk, but if the old cop thinks he can trace him down that way, he's in for a big surprise. Debbie's servers are in Eastern Europe, and in Eastern Europe, computer privacy is like cleanliness in America, next to godliness. So he goes, I swear this is true, he goes, there are plenty of young Christian women in our church who could show you how to fix yourself up, and if you grew your hair out, you'd look quite pretty. Do you believe it? So I tell him, with a little lip'em stick'em, you'd look darn pretty yourself. Put on a leather jacket and a dog collar, and you might luck into a hot date at the corral. Get your first squirt on the Tower of Power. So that buzzes him big time, and he goes, if you're going to get personal about this. Anyway, if the old cop wants to follow the computer trail, he'll have to turn the letter over to the cops in the technical section, and Brady doesn't think he'll do that. Not right away, at least. He's got to be bored sitting there with nothing but the TV for company. And the revolver, of course, the one he keeps beside him with his beer and magazines. Can't forget the revolver. Brady has never seen him actually stick it in his mouth, but several times he's seen him holding it. Shiny, happy people don't hold guns in their laps that way. So I tell him, I go, don't get mad. Somebody pushes back against your precious ideas, you guys always get mad. Have you noticed that about the Christers? He hasn't, but says he has. Only this one listened. He actually did. And we ended up going down to Hosini's Bakery and having coffee. Where, I know this is hard to believe, we actually did have something approaching a dialogue. I don't hold out much hope for the human race, but every now and then. Brady is pretty sure his letter will pep the old cop up, at least to start with. He didn't get all those citations for being stupid, and he'll see right through the veiled suggestion that he commits suicide the way Mrs. Trelawney did. Veiled? Not very. It's pretty much right out front. Brady believes the old cop will go all gung-ho, at least for a while. But when he fails to get anywhere, it will make the fall even more jarring. Then, assuming the old cop takes the Blue Umbrella bait, Brady can really go to work. The old cop is thinking, if I can get you talking, I can goad you. Only Brady is betting the old cop never read Nietzsche. Brady's betting the old cop is more of a John Grisham man. If he reads it all. When you gaze into the abyss, Nietzsche wrote, the abyss also gazes into you. I am
The abyss, old boy. Me. The old cop is certainly a bigger challenge than poor guilt-ridden Olivia Trelawney, but getting to her was such a hot hit to the nervous system that Brady can't help wanting to try it again. In some ways, prodding sweet Livy into high-siding it was a bigger thrill than cutting a bloody swath through that pack of job-hunting assholes at City Center. Because it took brains. It took dedication. It took planning. And a little bit of help from the cops didn't hurt either. Did they guess their faulty deductions were partly to blame for sweet Livy's suicide? Probably not Huntley. Such a possibility would never cross his plodder's mind. Ah, but Hodges, he might have his doubts. A few little mice nibbling at the wires back there in his smart cop brain. Brady hopes so. If not, he may get a chance to tell him. On the Blue Umbrella. Mostly, though, it was him. Brady Hartsfield. Credit where credit is due. City Center was a sledgehammer. On Olivia Trelawney, he used a scalpel. "Are you listening to me?" Freddy asks. He smiles. "Guess I drifted away there for a minute." Never tell a lie when you can tell the truth. The truth isn't always the safest course, but mostly it is. He wonders idly what she'd say if he told her, "Freddy, I am the Mercedes killer." Or if he said, "Freddy, there are 9 pounds of homemade plastic explosive in my basement closet." She is looking at him as if she can read these thoughts, and Brady has a moment of unease. Then she says, "It's working 2 jobs, pal. That'll wear you down." "Yes, but I'd like to get back to college, and nobody's going to pay for it but me. Also, there's my mother." "The wino." He smiles. "My mother is actually more of a vodka-o." "Invite me over," Freddy says grimly. "I'll drag her to a fucking AA meeting." "Wouldn't work. You know what Dorothy Parker said, right? You can lead a whore to culture, but you can't make her think." Freddy considers this for a moment, then throws back her head and voices a Marlboro raspy laugh. "I don't know who Dorothy Parker is, but I'm going to save that one." She sobers. "Seriously, why don't you just ask Frobisher for more hours? That other job of yours is strictly rinky-dink."
"I'll tell you why he doesn't ask Frobisher for more hours," Frobisher says, stepping out onto the loading platform. Anthony Frobisher is young and geekily bespectacled. In this, he is like most of the discount electronics employees. Brady is also young, but better looking than Tones Frobisher. Not that this makes him handsome, which is okay. Brady is willing to settle for nondescript. "Lay it on us," Freddy says and mashes her cigarette out. Across the loading zone behind the big box store, which anchors the south end of the Birch Hill Mall, are the employees' cars, mostly old beaters, and 3 VW Beetles painted bright green. These are always kept spotless, and late spring sun twinkles on their windshields. On the sides in blue is "Computer problems? Call the Discount Electronic Cyber Patrol." "Circuit City is gone, and Best Buy is tottering," Frobisher says in a schoolteacherly voice. "Discount Electronics is also tottering, along with several other businesses that are on life support thanks to the computer revolution, newspapers, book publishers, record stores, and the United States Postal Service, just to mention a few."
"Record stores?" Freddy asks, lighting another cigarette. "What are record stores?"
"That's a real gut buster," Frobisher says. "I have a friend who claims dykes lack a sense of humor, but..."
"You have friends?" Freddy asks. "Wow, who knew?"
"But you obviously prove him wrong. You guys don't have more hours because the company is now surviving on computers alone, mostly cheap ones made in China and the Philippines. The great majority of our customers no longer want the other shit we sell." Brady thinks only Tones Frobisher would say, "the great majority." "This is partly because of the technological revolution, but it's also because," together Freddy and Brady chant, "Barack Obama is the worst mistake this country ever made." Frobisher regards them sourly for a moment and says, "At least you listen. Brady, you're off at 2, is that correct?"
"Yes, my other gig starts at 3.
Frobisher wrinkles the overlarge schnozola in the middle of his face to show what he thinks of Brady's other job. "Did I hear you say something about returning to school?"
Brady doesn't reply to this because anything he says might be the wrong thing. Anthony Tones Frobisher must not know that Brady hates him. Fucking loathes him. Brady hates everybody, including his drunk mother, but it's like that old country song says, no one has to know right now. You're 28, Brady. Old enough so you no longer have to rely on shitty pool coverage to insure your automobile, which is good, but a little too old to be training for a career in electrical engineering, or computer programming for that matter.
Don't be a turd, Freddy says. Don't be a Tones turd.
If telling the truth makes a man a turd, then a turd I shall be.
Yeah, Freddy says, you'll go down in history. Tones the truth-telling turd. Kids will learn about you in school.
I don't mind a little truth, Brady says quietly. Good. You can don't mind all the time you're cataloging and stickering DVDs starting now. Brady nods good-naturedly, stands up and dusts the seat of his pants. The discount electronics 50% off sale starts the following week. Management in New Jersey has mandated that DE must be out of the digital versatile disc business by January of 2011. That once profitable line of merchandise has been strangled by Netflix and Redbox. Soon there will be nothing in the store but home computers made in China and the Philippines and flat-screen TVs which in this deep recession few can afford to buy. You, Frobisher says, turning to Freddy, have an out call. He hands her a pink work invoice. Old lady with a screen freeze. That's what she says it is anyway.
Yes, mon capitaine, I live to serve.
She stands up, salutes, and takes the call sheet he holds out. Tuck your shirt in. Put on your cap so your customer doesn't have to be disgusted by that weird haircut. Don't drive too fast. Get another ticket and life as you know it on the cyber patrol is over. Also, pick up your fucking cigarette butts before you go. He disappears inside before she can return his serve.
DVD stickers for you, an old lady with a CPU probably full of graham cracker crumbs for me. Freddy says, jumping down and putting her hat on.
She gives the bill a gangsta twist and starts across to the VWs without even glancing at her cigarette butts. She does pause long enough to look back at Brady, hands on her non-existent boy hips.
This is not the life I pictured for myself when I was in the fifth grade.
Me either, Brady says quietly. He watches her putt away. On a mission to rescue an old lady who's probably going crazy because she can't download her favorite mock apple pie recipe. This time Brady wonders what Freddy would say if he told her what life was like for him when he was a kid. That was when he killed his brother, and his mother covered it up. Why would she not? After all, it had sort of been her idea. 12. As Brady is slapping yellow 50% off stickers on old Quentin Tarantino movies and Freddy is helping out elderly Mrs. Vera Wilkins on the west side, it's her keyboard that's full of crumbs, it turns out. Bill Hodges is turning off Lowbrier, the four-lane street that bisects the city and gives Lowtown its name, and into the parking lot beside DeMaceo's Italian Ristorante. He doesn't have to be Sherlock Holmes to know Pete got here first. Hodges parks next to a plain gray Chevrolet sedan with black-walled tires that just about screams city police and gets out of his old Toyota, a car that just about screams old retired fella. He touches the hood of the Chevrolet. Warm. Pete has not beaten him by much. He pauses for a moment, enjoying this almost noon morning with its bright sunshine and sharp shadows, looking at the overpass a block down. It's been gang-tagged up the old wazoo, and although it's empty now, noon is breakfast time for the younger denizens of Lowtown, he knows that if he walked under there, he would smell the sour reek of cheap wine and whiskey. His feet would grate on the shards of broken bottles. In the gutters, more bottles. The little brown kind. No longer his problem. Besides, the darkness beneath the overpass is empty, and Pete is waiting for him. Hodges goes in and is pleased when Elaine at the hostess stand smiles and greets him by name, although he hasn't been here for months, maybe even a year. Of course, Pete is in one of the booths, already raising a hand to him, and Pete might have refreshed her memory, as the lawyers say. He raises his own hand in return, and by the time he gets to the booth, Pete is standing beside it, arms raised to envelop him in a bear hug. They thump each other on the back the requisite number of times, and Pete tells him he's looking good.
You know the three ages of man, don't you? Hodges asks. Pete shakes his head, grinning. Youth, middle age, and you look fucking terrific.
Pete roars with laughter and asks if Hodges knows what the blonde said when she opened the box of Cheerios. Hodges says he does not. Pete makes big amazed eyes and says,
Oh, look at the cute little donut seeds.
Hodges gives his own obligatory roar of laughter, although he does not think this a particularly witty example of genus blonde. And with the amenities thus disposed of, they sit down. A waiter comes over. No waitresses in DiMaggio's, only elderly men who wear spotless aprons tied up high on their narrow chicken chests. And Pete orders a pitcher of beer. Bud Light, not Ivory Special. When it comes, Pete raises his glass. Here's to you, Billy. And life after work. Thanks. They click and drink. Pete asks about Allie, and Hodges asks about Pete's son and daughter. Their wives, both of the X variety, are touched upon, as if to prove to each other and themselves that they are not afraid to talk about them, and then banished from the conversation. Food is ordered. By the time it comes, they have finished with Hodges' two grandchildren and have analyzed the chances of the Cleveland Indians, which happens to be the closest major league team. Pete has ravioli, Hodges' spaghetti with garlic and oil, what he has always ordered here. Halfway through these calorie bombs, Pete takes a folded piece of paper from his breast pocket and places it with some ceremony beside his plate. What's that? Hodges asks. Proof that my detective skills are as keenly honed as ever. I don't see you since that horror show at Rain Tree Inn. My hangover lasted 3 days, by the way. And I talked to you, what, twice? 3 times? Then bang, you asked me to lunch. Am I surprised? No. Do I smell an ulterior motive? Yes, so let's see if I'm right. Hodges gives a shrug. I'm like the curious cat. You know what they say? Satisfaction brought him back. Pete Huntley is grinning broadly, and when Hodges reaches for the folded slip of paper, Pete puts a hand over it. No, 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 no. You have to say it. Don't be coy, Kermit. Hodges sighs and ticks 4 items off on his fingers. When he's done, Pete pushes the folded piece of paper across the table. Hodges opens it and reads, 1. Davis. 2. Park rapist. 3. Pawn shops. 4. Mercedes killer. Hodges pretends to be discomfited.
You got me, Sheriff. Don't say a thing if you don't want to.
Pete grows serious. Jesus, if you weren't interested in the cases that were hanging fire when you hung up your jock, I'd be disappointed. I've been a little worried about you.
I don't want to horn in or anything.
Hodges is a trifle aghast at how smoothly this enormous whopper comes out.
Your nose is growing, Pinocchio.
No, seriously, all I want is an update.
Happy to oblige. Let's start with Donald Davis. You know the script. He fucked up every business he tried his hand at, most recently Davis Classic Cars. Guy so deep in debt he should change his name to Captain Nemo.
2 or 3 pretty kitties on the side. It was 3 when I called it a day, Hodges says, going back to work on his pasta. It's not Donald Davis he's here about, or the city park rapist, or the guy who's been knocking over pawn shops and liquor stores for the last 4 years. They are just camouflage, but he can't help being interested. Wife gets tired of the debt and the kitties. She's prepping the divorce papers when she disappears. Oldest story in the world. He reports her missing and declares bankruptcy on the same day. Does TV interviews and squirts a bucket of alligator tears. We know he killed her, but with no body, he shrugs. You were in on the meetings with Diana the dope. He's talking about the city's district attorney. Still can't persuade her to charge him.
No corpus delicious, no charge. The cops in Modesto knew Scott Peterson was guilty of sin and still didn't charge him until they recovered the bodies of his wife and kid. You know that.
Hodges does. He and Pete discussed Scott and Lacey Peterson a lot during their investigation of Sheila Davis's disappearance.
But guess what?
Blood's turned up in their summer cabin by the lake. Pete pauses for effect, then drops the other shoe. It's hers. Hodges leans forward, his food temporarily forgotten. When was this?
Last month.
And you didn't tell me?
I'm telling you now, because you're asking now. The search out there is ongoing. The Victor County cops are in charge.
Did anyone see him in the area prior to Sheila's disappearance?
Oh, yeah. Two kids.
Davis claimed he was mushroom hunting.
Fucking Yule Gibbons, you know? When they find the body, if they find it, old Donnie Davis can quit waiting for the 7 years to be up so he can petition to have her declared dead and collect the insurance.
Pete smiles widely. Think of the time he'll save. What about the park rapist?
It's really just a matter of time. We know he's white, we know he's in his teens or twenties, and we know he just can't get enough of that well-maintained, matronly pussy.
You're putting out decoys, right, because he likes the warm weather?
We are, and we'll get him.
It would be nice if you got him before he rapes another 50-something on our way home from work.
We're doing our best.
Pete looks slightly annoyed, and when their waiter appears to ask if everything's all right, Pete waves the guy away.
I know, Hodges says, soothingly.
Pawn shop guy? Pete breaks into a broad grin.
Young Aaron Jefferson.
Huh?
That's his actual name, although when he played football for City High, he called himself Y.A., you know, like Y.A. Tittle? Although his girlfriend, also the mother of his 3-year-old, tells us he calls the guy Y.A. Titties. When I asked her if he was joking or serious, she said she didn't have any idea.
Here's another story Hodges knows, another so old it could have come from the Bible, and there's probably a version of it in there someplace. Let me guess. He racks up a dozen jobs.
It's 14 now. Waving that sawed off around like Omar on The Wire.
And keeps getting away with it because he has the luck of the devil. Then he cheats on baby mama. She gets pissed and rats him out. Pete points a finger gun at his old partner.
Hole in one. And the next time young Aaron walks into a pawn shop or a check-cashing emporium with his belly gun, we'll know ahead of time. And it's angel, angel, down we go.
Why wait?
D.A. again, Pete says. You bring Diana the dope of steak, she says, cook it for me, and if it isn't medium rare, I'll send it back.
But you've got him.
I'll bet you a new set of white walls that Y.A. Titties is in county by the 4th of July and in state by Christmas. Davis and the park rapist may take a little longer, but we'll get them. You want dessert?
No.
Yes. To the waiter, he says, you still have that rum cake, the dark chocolate one?
The waiter looks insulted.
Yes, sir. Always.
I'll have a piece of that. And coffee.
Pete?
I'll settle for the last of the beer. So saying, he pours it out of the pitcher. You sure about that cake, Billy? You look like you've put on a few pounds since I saw you last.
It's true. Hodges eats heartily in retirement, but only for the last couple of days has food tasted good to him. I'm thinking about Weight Watchers.
Pete nods. Yeah? I'm thinking about the priesthood.
Fuck you. What about the Mercedes killer?
We're still canvassing the Trelawney neighborhood. In fact, that's where Isabel is right now. But I'd be shocked if she or anyone else comes up with a live lead. Izzy's not knocking on any doors that haven't been knocked on half a dozen times before. The guy stole Trelawney's luxury sled, drove out of the fog, did his thing, drove back into the fog, dumped it, and nothing. Never mind Monsieur Y.A. Titties, it's the Mercedes guy who really had the luck of the devil. If he'd tried that stunt even an hour later, there would have been cops there for crowd control.
I know.
Do you think he knew Billy?
Hodges tilts a hand back and forth to indicate it's hard to say. Maybe, if he and Mr. Mercedes should strike up a conversation on that Blue Umbrella website, he'll ask.
The murdering prick could have lost control when he started hitting people in crash, but he didn't. German engineering, best in the world, that's what Isabel says. Someone could have jumped on the hood and blocked his vision, but no one did. One of the posts holding up the Do Not Cross tape could have bounced under the car and gotten hung up there, but that didn't happen either. And someone could have seen him when he parked behind that warehouse and got out with his mask off, but no one did.
It was 5:20 in the morning, Hodges points out.
and even at noon that area would have been almost as deserted.
Because of the recession, Pete Huntley says moodily.
Yeah, yeah. Probably half the people who used to work in those warehouses were at City Center, waiting for the frigging job fair to start. Have some irony. It's good for your blood.
So you've got nothing.
Dead in the water.
Hodges' cake comes. It smells good and tastes better.
When the waiter's gone, Pete leans across the table. My nightmare is that he'll do it again. That another fog will come rolling in off the lake and he'll do it again.
He says he won't, Hodges thinks, conveying another forkload of the delicious cake into his mouth. He says he has absolutely no urge. He says once was enough.
That or something else, Hodges says. I got into a big fight with my daughter back in March, Pete says. Monster fight. I didn't see her once in April. She skipped all her weekends.
Yeah?
Uh-huh. She wanted to go see a cheerleading competition. Bring the Funk, I think it was called. Practically every school in the state was in it. You remember how crazy Candy always was about cheerleaders?
Yeah, Hodges says. He doesn't.
Had a little pleated skirt when she was 4 or 6 or something. We couldn't get her out of it. Two of the moms said they'd take the girls, and I told Candy no. You know why?
Sure he does.
Because the competition was at City Center, that's why. In my mind's eye, I could see about 1,000 tweeny boppers and their moms milling around outside, waiting for the doors to open, dusk instead of dawn, but you know the fog comes in off the lake then, too. I could see that cocksucker running at them in another stolen Mercedes, or maybe a fucking Hummer this time, and the kids and the mommies just standing there, staring like deer in the headlights. So I said no. You should have heard her scream at me, Billy, but I still said no. She wouldn't talk to me for a month, and she still wouldn't be talking to me if Maureen hadn't taken her. I told Mo, absolutely no way, don't you dare, and she said, that's why I divorced you, Pete, because I got tired of listening to no way and don't you dare. And of course, nothing happened.
He drinks the rest of the beer, then leans forward again.
I hope there are plenty of people with me when we catch him. If I nail him alone, I'm apt to kill him just for putting me on the outs with my daughter.
And why hope for plenty of people? Pete considers this, then smiles a slow smile.
You have a point there.
Do you ever wonder about Mrs. Trelawney? Hodges asks the question casually, but he has been thinking about Olivia Trelawney a lot since the anonymous letter dropped through the mail slot, even before then. On several occasions during the great time since his retirement, he has actually dreamed about her. That long face. The face of a woeful horse. The kind of face that says, nobody understands and the whole world is against me. All that money, and still unable to count the blessings of her life beginning with freedom from the paycheck. It had been years since Mrs. T had had to balance her accounts or monitor her answering machine for calls from bill collectors, but she could only count the curses, totting up a long account of bad haircuts and rude service people. Mrs. Olivia Trelawney, with her shapeless boat-neck dresses, said boats always listed either to starboard or to port. The watery eyes that always seemed on the verge of tears. No one had liked her, and that included Detective First Grade Kermit William Hodges. No one had been surprised when she killed herself, including that self-same Detective Hodges. The deaths of 8 people, not to mention the injuries of many more, was a lot to carry on your conscience.
Wonder about her how? Pete asks.
If she was telling the truth, after all, about the key. Pete raises his eyebrows.
She thought she was telling it. You know that as well as I do. She talked herself into it so completely she could have passed a lie detector test.
It's true. And Olivia Trelawney hadn't been a surprise to either of them. God knows they had seen others like her. Career criminals acted guilty even when they hadn't committed the crime or crimes they had been hauled in to discuss because they knew damned well they were guilty of something. Solid citizens just couldn't believe it, and when one of them wound up being questioned prior to charging, Hodges knows it was hardly ever because a gun was involved. No, it was usually a car. I thought it was a dog I ran over, they'd say. and no matter what they might have seen in the rearview mirror after the awful double thump, they'd believe it. Just a dog. "I wonder, though," Hodges says, hoping he seems thoughtful rather than pushy. "Come on, Bill. You saw what I saw, and any time you need a refresher course, you can come down to the station and look at the photos." "I suppose." The opening bars of "Night on Bald Mountain" sound from the pocket of Pete's men's warehouse sport coat. He digs out his phone, looks at it, and says, "I gotta take this." Hodges makes a be-my-guest gesture. "Hello?" Pete listens. His eyes grow wide, and he stands up so fast his chair almost falls over. "What?" Other diners stop eating and look around. Hodges watches with interest. "Yeah. Yeah. I'll be right there." "What?" "Yeah, yeah, okay. Don't wait, just go." He snaps the phone closed and sits down again. All his lights are suddenly on, and in that moment, Hodges envies him bitterly. "I should eat with you more often, Billy. You're my lucky charm, always were. We talk about it, and it happens." "What?" Thinking, it's Mr. Mercedes. The thought that follows is both ridiculous and forlorn. He was supposed to be mine. That was Izzy. She just got a call from a state police colonel out in Victory County. A game warden spotted some bones in an old gravel pit about an hour ago. The pit's less than 2 miles from Donnie Davis's summer place on the lake, and guess what? The bones appear to be wearing the remains of a dress. He raises his hand over the table. Hodges high-fives it. Pete returns the phone to its sagging pocket and brings out his wallet. Hodges shakes his head, not even kidding himself about what he feels. Relief. Enormous relief. "No, this is my treat. You're meeting Isabel out there, right?" "Right." "Then roll." "Okay. Thanks for lunch." "One other thing. Hear anything about Turnpike Joe?" "That's state," Pete says. "And the feebles now. They're welcome to it. What I hear is they've got nothing, just waiting for him to do it again and hoping to get lucky." He glances at his watch. "Go, go." Pete starts out, stops, returns to the table, and puts a big kiss on Hodges' forehead. "Great to see you, sweetheart." "Get lost," Hodges tells him. "People will say we're in love." Pete scrams with a big grin on his face, and Hodges thinks of what they sometimes used to call themselves, the Hounds of Heaven. He wonders how sharp his own nose is these days. 13. The waiter returns to ask if there will be anything else. Hodges starts to say no, then orders another cup of coffee. He just wants to sit here a while, savoring double happiness. It wasn't Mr. Mercedes, and it was Donnie Davis, the sanctimonious cocksucker who killed his wife and then had his lawyer set up a reward fund for information leading to her whereabouts. Because, oh Jesus, he loved her so much, and all he wanted was for her to come home so they could start over. He also wants to think about Olivia Trelawney, and Olivia Trelawney's stolen Mercedes. That it was stolen, no one doubts. But in spite of all her protests to the contrary, no one doubts that she enabled the thief. Hodges remembers a case that Isabel Janes, then freshly arrived from San Diego, told them about after they brought her up to speed on Mrs. Trelawney's inadvertent part in the city center massacre. In Isabel's story, it was a gun. She said she and her partner had been called to a home where a 9-year-old boy had shot and killed his 4-year-old sister. They had been playing with an automatic pistol their father had left on his bureau. "The father wasn't charged, but he'll carry that for the rest of his life," she said. "This will turn out to be the same kind of thing. Wait and see." That was a month before the Trelawney woman swallowed the pills, maybe less, and nobody on the Mercedes killer case had given much of a shit. To them, and him, Mrs. T had just been a self-pitying rich lady who refused to accept her part in what had happened. The Mercedes SL was downtown when it was stolen, but Mrs. Trelawney, a widow who lost her wealthy husband to a heart attack, lived in Sugar Heights, a suburb as rich as its name where lots of gated drives led up to 14 and 20-room McMansions. Hodges grew up in Atlanta, and whenever he drives through Sugar Heights, he thinks of a ritzy Atlanta neighborhood called Buckhead. Mrs. T's elderly mother, Elizabeth Wharton, lived in an apartment a very nice one with rooms as big as a political candidate's promises, in an upscale condo cluster on Lake Avenue. The crib had space enough for a live-in housekeeper, and a private nurse came 3 days a week. Mrs. Wharton had advanced scoliosis, and it was her OxyContin that her daughter had filched from the apartment's medicine cabinet when she decided to step out. Suicide proves guilt. He remembers